Hello, this is Melissa. Today is the 9th of June, 2024. I hope everyone is doing all right. Long story short, there is nothing wrong with my car, and it did not cost me anything to figure that out, so that's okay. I think really what I'm learning is a different way of putting it into reverse. It's an older car, and I guess things just change over time, and my mind went to worst-case scenario, but it's okay. I also want to mention Tragedy and Hope Book Club. So it's been about 5 full weeks since we had an installment, and part of that is because of how busy I have been. But I wanted to say, first off, that Darren and Andrea in South Africa are just doing a wonderful job of administrating the CTTM book club site. They just do a great job. And every time I have a chance to check in over there and, you know, hear what people are talking about, listen to some of the recorded comments, I'm always learning something. So I appreciate it. So what we're going to try this month is the actual kind of book club talk, Q&A, and involvement. And that's going to be done on Telegram. Darren is going to be leading on the 15th of this month, which is next Saturday night, the talk on Chapter 7, Finance, Commercial Policy, and Business Activity, 1897 to 1947. And then Nick from Hayes Reviews is going to be covering Section 8, which is International Socialism and the Soviet Challenge. And that will be on the 22nd. So the way these will work in the chat room, there'll be moderated chats where people can have questions, make comments, interact, and someone will moderate that, meaning, you know, help you know when to mute and unmute your microphone. So that's the setup there. Now, for those of you who aren't in the Telegram book club and don't visit the chat there, don't worry, because these talks will be recorded as the others have been, and I'll post those later on the different channels. So it's just a different way of doing this. It's a little more like a book club, and it'll be interesting to see how it goes. For those of you who have already done all of that reading and you're up to date, we're going to go ahead and have a new reading assignment, but we'll extend this out. Instead of this being June's reading assignment, this will be for all of June and July. And I think that that's good. It's summertime and people have their focus in a lot of different directions. Some people have children and, you know, etc. So for that period, the new assignments are Section 9 and 10. 9 is Germany from Kaiser to Hitler, 1913 to 1945. And Section 10 is Britain, the background to appeasement, 1900 to 1939. Look forward to seeing you all, or hearing you all, I think, because it's not a camera done thing, but hearing you all in these upcoming chats on the 15th and the 22nd. So I just wanted to talk about a couple of things that were on my mind and the process of selecting this redux, and I'll give you some themes, some keywords, if you will. Ages, the age of humanity. Who's at the top? Language. How do we hear what we hear and see what we see in the form of language? I got a letter from someone and they mentioned that they had been re-listening several times to a talk of Alan's. This is one that I posted about a year and a half ago as a redux entitled Tinkering in the Matrix of the Womb. And that was from December the 14th, 2006. And I mentioned it, I don't think I mentioned it by name, but I mentioned it a few months ago as being one of a couple of talks that were pulled down from one of my major sites for medical misinformation. So I'll have to do a little editing on even what I say for those sites. What I countered with is Alan was only reading an article from a medical journal, but they stood by their decision, and that was that. I will only be using a few sections from this talk, and then I'm going to combine them with some sections from another talk entitled Chaos, Conflict, and Keratos. And that is from January 12, 2007. So it's about a month apart. And there are sections of this, both of these talks, where Alan talks about ages, how old we are, even gets into a little bit of who is at the top or what is at the top. I sometimes struggle with the idea of the redux, of bringing back, because I know that what I'm supposed to be doing is not just, oh, you know, mindlessly putting it up there just to fill the space or remind you, oh, here, this was, you know, a unique thinker with an interesting point of view. Alan's work, his lifetime accumulation of knowledge, had shown him that there is an ideology at the top, that it permeates the agenda that is run intergenerationally by elite families. Bit of breeding, bit of ideology. And they do have an end game in mind. They do have a direction that they're taking us. Several times over the years, both in writing and verbally, Alan has talked about the end of an age or the end of humanity. And he mentioned that again in this talk, and I won't read much of it because this is the section that I'm going to play. But he does say here, we're witnessing the end of humanity as we know it. So I think that the censorship grid called this medical misinformation because it is actually true that they can change humanity. This is not a future wish, a future goal, that they can change humanity before we're born. This is a fact. This is occurring. And if you look around at smaller shoulder width for men, narrower hips for women, in many ways you can see it demonstrated. Yes, they have done this. It's not just something that they wanted to do or that they talk about doing. It's like chemtrails that we can see versus geoengineering that we are told might be necessary. Someone had earlier, a listener a couple of years ago, supplied us with an excerpt series entitled Purpose Made People. And this ran, I don't remember how many installments of it were, but you could go and look for those excerpt clips, Purpose Made People. Because they just took Alan talking to demonstrate how we are, have already been made, are being made, purpose made, or how the controllers want us to be designed, how they want us to be. Alan never tried to catalog his work into or organize it in a system where he said, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then, and here's where it starts at the top, because you can do a lot of research for yourself, you can read a lot of books, and you can come to your own conclusions. But when you start organizing it into a historical system to explain what reality is, where we've been and where we're going and who's in charge, you're going to miss key elements because you're human and you do not have access to the archives that are passed down intergenerationally. You can make your best speculative guess because we are definitely limited in what is given to us to know at this level. That aside, one of the beauties of Alan's thinking, and this was a thought process, but his thought process was informed by his years and years and years of research and reading and looking into history from a variety of angles, was that we're not up against an enemy that cannot be defeated. We are not up against a cataclysm from which there is no survival. We are, some of us can come through. Alan always said you have to think your way out of this. And I think for a lot of people, the thinking always ends up with going to someone else's organized system of thought, someone else's homework, and saying, yes, that resonates as true for me. But unfortunately, what happens when you go that way is that you are too easily misled, because you're going to another human to confirm for you something which you have to think your way out of. You've got to use all of your senses and more. Alan talked in a redux that I put up recently about language, about you needed all five of your senses in order to use language. And knowing that language is created as a form of control, it's created and recreated down through time. So you see the word, you hear the word, you also communicate with verbal and nonverbal information. You can touch something and learn about it. Water, for instance. I was pouring out a pitcher of water this morning and I was listening to the sound as it hit the pitcher. And I was watching it come out. And I was thinking, if I smelled this and it smelled like anything, then that would tell me that there was something wrong with the water, would it not? If I tasted it and it tasted like something, it may not necessarily be bad, but it would tell me it, you know, it had a high mineral content, for instance. So language is more than words on the paper, more than words that you hear, more than words that an actor says or a news anchor. Language is how we communicate, but there is more to communication than the word, the written word, or the word sounded out. And then there's spelling, the spell. Alan always talked about we're under the spell. I say that I return to him and his willingness to go out on a limb from time to time. To say that he never speculated, I don't see that. I don't agree with that. But his speculation was incredibly well informed. So in thinking about language and reading the news, I mean, there, you know, it's hard to even know what to focus on now, because the ongoing, will there be peace in the Middle East or not, and when will it happen, and they're negotiating for the release of this many hostages, but what happened is Israel bombed a school where there was supposedly a new Hamas stronghold there, and dozens of people were killed. Four hostages were released. Another 200 plus Palestinians were killed, near as I can figure it out, Israel rescued 4 hostages. The Gazan officials say that that rescue operation killed more than 200 Palestinians. This happened in some kind of refugee camp. And then meanwhile, in another bombing operation, dozens of Palestinians were killed in a school that they say has been used for people who have lost their homes and have nowhere to go. And I wasn't sure initially, I was kind of confused if the school and the refugee camp were the same place, but I don't think it is. I think these are 2 different events that happened. Our attention is constantly in the news being pulled this way or being pulled that way with things that are trivial or things that are important. People are suffering, or we're just told that this is something really important that we need to pay attention to. So language. And because freedom of speech is disappearing very quickly in many parts of the world. So that's the words that we speak, and how do we speak them, and what is safe to say and what not. I received a story from Neil Foster yesterday, and that was an obviously morbidly obese woman who had won some sort of pageant in Alabama. And she is a plus-size model, talked about bullying and how hurtful it was when she won, that people said, is this what they find attractive in Alabama, and so forth. But it made me think about cognitive dissonance. We're told that we don't want to be heavy. We don't want to be obese, and we're constantly told that different things incline us towards obesity. Is it seed oils or processed sugar, or, you know, so morbid obesity is described by the World Health Organization and other official bodies and agencies as killing millions. I think I read in 2017 nearly 5 million people were said to have died of obesity. Is this an illness or a condition related to obesity? And through the time of COVID, we were told that obesity was a comorbidity and cause of death. So it's the constant doublethink, where we're supposed to have body positivity and not be hateful because all different kinds of body types and sizes are good. And what language is okay to use? How is it okay to describe this person? I went to the post office this week. It was really incredibly hot and humid, just unbearable weather. The clerk, a really nice lady, was just sweaty, even though there was air conditioning. And I said, it's just a miserable day, isn't it? And I said, even with the air conditioning running, you just can't keep cool enough. And she said, well, it's not a fat girl day, that's for sure. Now, she is fat. I'd say she's easily 5'10", but probably closer to 6 feet tall. She's a large woman, big. And I'm a small woman. I'm about 5'3" and slim. And I said, well, it's not a skinny girl day either. And we laughed, and she said, yeah, but it's really not a fat girl day. And she always takes pride in her appearance. She's got a rhinestone-coated Apple Watch. Her nails are always done. Her hair's pulled back. She's got a bit of makeup on. She has some pride of appearance. But she is not telling me that she is something other than what she is, which is a fat girl. She's a big girl. And she doesn't mind using the word fat. But here is this woman who just won a pageant in Alabama, who is girth-wise much bigger than the postal clerk, who's taking offense. And I'm not for bullying. It's sad people are what they are, but it made me think of the movie Branded that I saw. I'm not really recommending it as a particularly good movie. It was a Russian movie that came out in about 2012. I watched it with Alan. And there it's got a whole mixed bag of things going on there. It's some kind of sci-fi or fantasy. I'm not really sure what you'd call it. It was an odd movie. But there was a marketing executive in the movie, and he catches wind of a marketing campaign that is being paid for by fast food companies, and what the goal of it is to make fat beautiful. This guy ends up going and retreating out into the away from civilization for a while, and he gets involved in some sort of almost supernatural ritual where he takes a red heifer and burns it and uses the ashes of the red heifer to purify himself. You know, so what I'm saying, it's a weird movie. But I always thought of that when I saw a few years ago the push on for plus size models in all of the different magazines. Or I got a catalog of something that obviously my mother had subscribed to years ago that just keeps coming, and it was full of, came at Christmas time, full of plus size models. And you never saw that 10 years ago. You did not see that ubiquitously at the time that movie Branded was made. But now you do. Now you see body positivity, fat is beautiful, plus size models, modeling lingerie, modeling swimsuits. This is what you see. But it was her offense to the language that was being used that made me stop and think. Because when someone is offended, then it's easy to say that the person who has offended them has been guilty of hate, right? That's hateful. And I was scrolling through the news looking at, you know, important things to be focused on, and I saw something on the side of the page of what I was looking at that was not an important story at all, but it really did steer me in a completely different direction this morning. And it was a link to an article from People magazine, and it said, "Teenager leaves parents on Caribbean island to get back to cruise on time. They missed the departure by a lot." The teen writes that their parents were busy shopping and bargaining with the locals while their cruise ship was getting ready to leave port. A recent high school graduate is going viral. Okay, so the graduate's going viral, not the post, right? I mean, this is just indicative of how sloppy our use of language has gotten. A recent high school graduate is going viral after sharing that they left their parents on a Caribbean island so they could get back to a cruise on time, and the parents missed the boat. In a post shared to Reddit, the teenager says that their parents recently gifted them a family cruise in honor of turning 18 and graduating high school. Okay, sloppy language. I know a lot of people use that, but gifted is when you are exceptionally bright or talented. This is what it means to be gifted. Otherwise, you are giving someone a gift. So it's just an example of newspeak, that's all. Anticipating that their parents might not be able to stick to the planned nature of a cruise, they write that they told them that if we went on excursions, we had to follow the schedule no matter what. "Well, it was a week-long cruise, and they would not head back to the ship when I said it was time to go," the teen writes. "They were busy shopping and bargaining with the locals. I finally said that I was heading back to the ship. My mom waved me off." Ultimately, the teen adds, the missed the departure. You know, typo there. That should have been they missed the departure by a lot, like 45 minutes. They got a hold of me through WhatsApp. They wanted to know why I didn't get the boat to wait for them, the teen writes. The teen adds that they wanted to scream at their parents that they were not going to inconvenience 3,998 people because two could not understand what a schedule was. They ended up having to fly to the next port from there, and it was expensive, the teen writes. They are pissed at me for leaving them behind. So I thought, well, that is just bizarre. I mean, am I left to think that this teen's pronouns, their preferred pronouns, are they, them, there? Is that the point of this article? Because I can tell you, this is not news. This does not belong in any kind of a national or international paper, the fact that somebody missed their departure on a cruise, right? This is not news. So why am I being given it? Why am I told that I should look at this and I should know this? I stumbled on a writer writing for Teen Vogue, and this was back in 2021. They, them pronouns, all your questions about gender-neutral pronouns answered. From the history of gender-neutral pronouns, they aren't new, to what to do if you mess it up. People say the darndest things about they, them pronouns. When I tell someone that my pronouns are they, them, there, I never know what to expect. Sometimes people say okay and move on, but other times they'll start asking a whole bunch of questions that I don't really feel like answering. It's usually well-intentioned. I get that people are just trying to understand, but I do get tired of explaining the same things about gender-neutral pronouns over and over. This is painful, and I will post do it, but I won't read the whole thing. I'll say it's painful because what this young adult is doing is taking their preferred pronouns and beating you over the head with them and telling you that you should feel guilty, you should apologize if you misgender or if you don't use the pronouns or if you're reluctant to use the pronouns that they want you used, right? But they did make one point that was true. Sometimes you do say they, them, when you're talking about one person. And the example that this writer gives is, oh, someone dropped their money here. I'll set it aside for them. I bet they are looking everywhere. They go on to say, you wouldn't write, I'll set it aside for him or her. I bet he or she is looking everywhere for it. So they use the singular they instead. As it turns out, what I had seen in People magazine about they, them complaining about their parents, this was the biggest coverage that this non-story got. I saw the same story, though, in smaller publications geared towards the cruise ship community, like trade magazines, Reddit. Other smaller outlets had picked it up. And when they picked up the story, they actually wrote about a young man who had recently graduated from high school, and he was given a gift of a cruise by his parents, and he wrote the story of them wandering off to go shopping and missing the deadline for the departure of the cruise ship. And I found it very interesting that when People magazine, again, the biggest outlet, picked it up, they made sure to scrub all reference to the fact that it was a man who was writing about it. Why would they do that? Before I had even stumbled on that, I felt that the whole point of this was to push the gender-neutral pronouns. And once I found the sequence of the articles, that certainly confirmed it for me. So it's just, be really careful of anything that you look at, because it's all so carefully managed for your consumption. what is it that they want us to consume? Who was just telling me about gender pronouns was a young woman who is non-binary, who has changed their name to a male name, and I don't know what kind of transitioning they've done, if they've done any, but they identify as a little of this and a little of that. And it's easy to say that these people are mentally ill, that they're suffering from some kind of mental illness. But if you think about the whole point of Alan's talk here, tinkering in the matrix of the womb, how long have they been tinkering in the matrix of the womb? And just as a little aside there on the red heifer situation, I did learn that there is an organization in Israel called the Temple Institute that is focused on establishing the third temple, rebuilding of the temple. And to that end, they want that perfect red heifer that they can sacrifice and use the ashes. They had found two candidates, one in 1997 and another in 2002, that they initially declared kosher and suitable for sacrifice, but they found some flaws with them and therefore they couldn't do it. Now listen to this. The Institute has been raising funds in order to use modern technology to produce a red heifer that is genetically based on the red Angus. In September 2018, the Institute announced a red heifer candidate was born, saying the heifer is currently a viable candidate and will be examined to see whether it possesses the necessary qualifications for the red heifer for sacrifice. In September 2022, 5 red cows were imported from the United States and transferred to a breeding farm in a West Bank settlement. Rabbis consider the cows kosher for sacrifice. Now, as far as I know, they have not sacrificed those 5 red heifers for the rebuilding of what was called Solomon's Temple, the rebuilding of the temple on the Temple Mount. Just interesting. Like I say, Alan didn't have the, oh, this is definitely who is at the top, and they came from here, and I think that that is important to return to time and again, because I think it's important to return to now, because I can see that we are moving very quickly along multiple tracks at the same time to go into whatever you want to call it. I'm just going to call it the next age. Listen to what Alan has to say about separation. Again, I said I'd play it and not read it, but it's so important that I think I want to stress it just a little bit. After he said, "We're witnessing the end of humanity as we know it," he said, "In all the holy books in other countries have this fable story in it, whatever it is. Even Judaism has in it that we go through these cycles," and then he said Talmudic Judaism, "and reach a point of total debasement, and then catastrophe comes and people are wiped away. I have to admit, I've seen the good and the bad in my life and extremes. I've seen the many in-betweens, but I've certainly seen the extremes. Today, there are very few people who truly care about what's going on. Don't be misled by groups and NGOs who are authorized by the big boys, who are always spouting for more things for the workers, or this or that or the other. This is all part of the agenda. I'm talking about people who really care, not because they're paid to, not because they say all the right things and have an ulterior agenda. Today we're seeing the dividing line between those who care and the majority who do not. The point is past, in fact. It's already decided, and most do not care." This, he said earlier, is a separation. a telling period for humanity. The separation has been talked about in previous ages, where society gets to such a state of corruption from the top to the bottom that something happens, either man-made or whatever, and most people are wiped out. Others have taken some sort of moral stance concerning the story, that there's a change in certain humans themselves. There are certain humans alive who are different from the rest, and these ones come through, whereas those who are still base do not. I'm always sensitive to those things that Alan said, and I feel that we are at a time when there needs to be a highlighter run through them, an underline in red ink put underneath it. Not to be preachy, but to show you this is what he said, and to ask the question, what do you think he meant? I got an email from the same person who told me they were re-listening to this talk repeatedly. And they told me that, okay, so I won't name names, but two names who are quite big, huge, as a matter of fact. You might even call them fat within the truther movement, the alternative movement. We're speaking to one another in an interview that was just posted in the last day or so. And the title of the interview was roughly, aliens are giving the command for the destruction of humanity, something like that. And I sat there and listened to these people and just rapid fire with lots of fear mongering going on, talking about interdimensional travel and FTL, right? Because everybody knows that FTL is faster than light travel, okay? So getting directives from these alien forces as to how to destroy humanity. They were serious. This was a serious conversation. And one of these very big, well-known people was saying, but it works. It doesn't just work where the aliens, who he also called cosmic AI, were sending, they were transmitting their instructions they were transmitting their instructions for the destruction of humanity, but it worked also from God. And he said, with a straight face, I receive transmissions from God on how to counter this. This is what we're up against. This is what you go up against if you don't think for yourself out of this. If you look to someone else to be the hero, to show you how to get past, then you're in danger. You have to guard your mind and what goes into your mind very carefully. I just wanted to share just a couple of things because we are at a point where the words that we say, we don't have that much more time to say them, at least not without, you know, I have to edit certain things that I put up every week, you know, to make sure, okay, let's get rid of that word, let's try this a different way. So I was looking for Alan talking about thought in his different talks. And one thing that I see as a through line in his work, going way back to the very beginning, is how your thoughts will no longer be safe. This is from 2012, a poem. Just thinking, you say thoughts are yours, of course. Investigate origin and purpose of source. A totalitarian system fosters uniformity of opinion set by higher dominion for each and every minion. Such secret of success is the minions never guess. They're guided, praised, chided by masters more or less. Ecology rearranges the mind for planned changes, turns nations into cages, supporting free trade stages, redistributing wealth opens up to ill health as they monopolize by stealth food on the shelf. This plan's scientifically strong, using right and wrong. Trick is to get the throng demanding to play along. And haven't we seen that? Haven't we seen that? This one is also from 2012, The Fabian Way, a society run by science, by those who know better, planned centuries ago, being followed to the letter. Children with slate-clean minds are indoctrinated with the very values predecessors fought and hated, a generation passing and substituting names. Degradation of culture has revealed communist aims, which are now global. And with global education, ensures every child gets Soviet indoctrination. Now, with MIT's latest shiny mind machine, all calls and emails scanned, also what you dream. To see if you're upset with where we are going. You could end in the gulag, lots of sacks and sewing, or rehabilitated to right think, unless you're too far gone. Thoughts may contaminate others, won't be around for long. This is from 2010. Peace is the absence of all opposition. You'll eventually volunteer for local agrarian, showing you're a good citizen and communitarian. Strange how the similarities of Soviet ideal, which never materialized since it was unreal, are introduced worldwide as the final solution to claimed overpopulation and people pollution. Could those same families with historical mission who created foundations, gave us nuclear fission, and directed great wars while profiting well, be still striving to bring in their utopian hell upon the whole earth with people modified, people unsuspecting their masters lied? Yes, the goal of these families won't cease or desist till their dark world is manifest. No thoughts exist. 2010 again, moral relativity. Thinking own thoughts, doing own thing. All within you, master builders did bring. In moral relativity, nothing's despicable. Masses adapt in ways most predictable. Few catch on in the course of a lifetime, their values upgraded from shows primetime. Monkey see, monkey do works very well, creating society which is chaotic as hell. Lots of government agencies deal with fallout as the culture creators pull all the stops out. Lifestyles, vocabulary, and ways to dress. To know how to be, just look at the rest. Hedonism and psychopathy create predators, copied by all, promiscuous, no fetters. Yet the clever plan from London to Laos is to create dysfunction for order from chaos. When the global society's in complete ruination, the masters come forth with their new creation. From planners like Russell, writers like Sutton, sheep can't complain about price of mutton. Alan wrote a lot about thought. One of the reasons was, as he said, thought is powerful. Thought has its own life form. Thought can be transmitted. We have to find a new way of communicating with each other, those of us who care. Alan always said you could communicate wordlessly. And could it be that we'll have to brush up on that parietal part of the brain and learn that? I'm about to speak a little German here, which I don't speak, so forgive me. But I saw this in the Tragedy and Hope book club chat room this afternoon. Someone shared a German folk song. This was an antidote to something else that had been shared that was kind of ugly and degraded. They said, I like the lyrics of this old folk song. Die Gedanken sind frei. Die Gedanken sind frei. And what does that mean? Thoughts are free. This is a German song about freedom of thought. One of the through lines in Alan's work to me, think your way out of this for yourself. And could it be that your mind is the last stronghold of freedom? So in the English, the lyrics say, thoughts are free, who can guess them? They fly by like nocturnal shadows, no person can know them, no hunter can shoot them, and so it'll always be. Thoughts are free. I think what I want and what delights me, still always reticent as it is suitable. My wish and desire, no one can deny me, and so it'll always be. Thoughts are free. I love wine and my girl even more. Only her I like best of all. I'm not alone with my glass of wine. My girl is with me. Thoughts are free. And if I'm thrown into the darkest dungeon, all these are futile works because my thoughts tear all gates and walls apart. Thoughts are free. So I will renounce my sorrows forever and never again will torture myself with whimsies. In one's heart, one can always laugh and joke and think at the same time. Thoughts are free. They say they don't know who the original lyricist and composer was, but the most popular version of the song was done in 1842. What Ellen was trying to convey in talks such as Tinkering in the Matrix of the Womb and through all of the poems and the talks he did over the years is, how long do we have until our thoughts are not our own? Are we already there? So for those of you who are seeking your mind, may be the last refuge. So guard it carefully. And I'll talk to you all later and have a good week. And keep an eye out for book club postings. Take care.
Hi, folks. This is Alan Watt at cuttingthroughthematrix.com. It is December the 14th, 2006. And I'd like to follow up last night's talk with something connected, in a sense. This is about how the scientists are now going into the womb to alter fetuses. And this is a story they're giving us as to the reasons, and you can bet your bottom dollar these are only part of the reasons, if any of the reasons at all. The real reasons are to find out if they can tamper and alter basically DNA, the DNA structure of a developing fetus. That's what's really behind all of this, to re-engineer humanity. This one's done under DNA vaccine, immunizes fetal lambs. So as always, under the guise of helping to prevent something that will harm us, the most ancient technique that's ever been used in history, they're into it, they're in there already. And you can bet your bottom dollar, as this group here, these various groups are working on animals, farm animals, you can bet your bottom dollar there are higher groups that have already been doing the same thing with human beings and human fetuses. This is the intelligent design, the ID, the real meaning of ID, the intelligent design they want to get to. The human who will grow up being the exact thing that is programmed to be, programmed by those who've authorized or been authorized to program it. The perfect human for the perfect system. That's where scientists are. And these announcements that go out through different publications are not meant just for those in that field of research. It's really meant for the general public. Gradually, you're being conditioned step by step to the inevitability of this. This is standard technique. What these people never discuss is where their research money comes from, because that's how you direct society. Always you steer society. Anyone who thinks that scientists just leave university, get a job, and are allowed to work in any field in any direction they wish are up a gum tree. The big foundations, in collaboration with the secret services of countries like the MI5 or MI6 or CIA or Mossad are the ones that direct all research. And we know, as I've said already, that in the 50s and 60s there were many publications came out from science fields talking about the creation of new types of humans and how they'd have to get into it. And they knew, and that's why they know, you see, they could always pull off what they want. They direct the funding into any particular area, and it becomes so. Those who go off on their own and try to do something really wonderful for society will find they can't get grants from government or the foundations. They're told where to go into, what the direction they have to go into. While we hurry and scurry in our lives and are kept busy trying to keep either afloat, or we play with our dysfunctional families, or you're busy doing overtime to keep up with all the things that you either want or at the bottom, the basic things that you need, you don't really have time to digest all that's happening, really happening in the real world. The stuff that the news barely touches on, once in a blue moon they'll touch on something as though it were a curiosity and go on to trivia or sports or something, and then it's out of your head. But it's conditioning you that to accept the inevitability of certain lines of research. Recently, I've talked to people who really care about others in this world, and they become terribly distraught when they find that most people don't really care about other people. And it's a hard thing for those who do care to find out and really get it through their heads that that's the world they live in. Most people are egocentric. They do that which pleases them. They avoid pain. That can also be helped along through psychological techniques. And sure enough, Bertrand Russell and other ones mentioned that they would create an egocentric society. That was all part of what the New Age was created to be, to avoid things which make you feel unpleasant. I don't want to hear that. Don't tell me that. It's upsetting. Look on the bright side. Don't be a downer. You know, when there's a forest fire, the animals run for it. When sheep get spooked, they bolt in all directions. And they're supposedly the most domesticated animal alongside the dairy cow. And dairy cows themselves, if they've been chosen to go off to slaughter, seem to know it's coming. They have almost a psychic awareness of something happening. And I've seen a neighbor who had cattle. His cattle would be lowing all night long before the truck would come in the morning. All night long, most sorrowful sound you'd ever hear. They just seemed to know. Yet mankind, humankind, overtakes them in its domesticity. We've had more work done on us through psychological methods and inoculations to lobotomize specific parts of the brain, like Kostler said in The Ghost in the Machine. And you can see it all around you. You see those who don't want to know any bad news. It's a downer. I want to be happy. I, me, 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 I. And yet the survival of humankind in all ages is dependent on the caring of each individual for the others. Otherwise you have chaos, and such a people will vanish. That's a very telling point, actually, because civilizations have gone in the past, gone down because of that very problem. The elite think they have it all in hand. they care about each other, they know the necessity of caring for each other, at least making sure that they're all in their same positions and standing by each other. They close ranks and stand by each other. But those people down below are running around chasing gurus, new age, reptilian people, everything you can imagine, anything which excites and titillates the imagination, but they don't want to hear the bad news. And they don't want to know that there are people amongst them who work in projects which would be given the Iron Cross for Joseph Mengele's research. And they could be living next door to you even. There's a lot of very nasty, evil people, and I've talked to some of them. I've heard people tell me, I've met some of them who work for the big boys. One was a woman who was a teacher, a strange kind of teacher, because from a very old family, very wealthy old upper family, who could take 6 months off in the year and go off to China, and obviously paid to do so, and of other countries. And I was talking to her when she came back. And because I understand so many topics, I got chatting to her, and she knew me. Standing outside a general store in the middle of nowhere. And she rather carried away about the Chinese system. You see, the Chinese system is to be the model system for the world. There is mandatory abortion for second child families. And she carried away about their techniques for manipulating society into all being one, like one giant anthill, all going in the same direction with the same one mindset. How they've managed very successfully to sort of downplay individualism and make them all feel part of this great oneness. And that's why it's the model state for the world, according to the United Nations. But she was carried away, and she said, she said, do so well with her population problem. And I played along and said, oh, really? She says, oh, yes, they had it all done so well. And it's true, because in the early days of communism in China, when the word filtered back through the spies in society to the top, they'd send out troops to pick up people in their homes and drag the women off to the clinics for the abortion. And now, with the psychological technique of approval, social approval and social disapproval, they don't have to do that anymore, because their neighbors themselves will force the woman and escort her to the abortion clinic. See, most people really are not individuals at all. They're composites of their brainwashings. It's like someone who notices your car, that someone you know very well, and you say, well, my emergency brake isn't attached. And they'll look at you like, oh, that's illegal. Really concerned, because to them, illegal means something nasty, nasty, nasty. And law is just law. It's a bunch of commands put out by people at the top. And laws can be anything. But some people who are composites and who don't think for themselves can be and are your worst enemies in any society. People you might have known for years even, but you watch their Pavlovian responses, and that's what it is. It's Pavlovian responses, you're seeing, of their indoctrinations. And this woman who was telling me about this, about China, prattled on and glorified their techniques for getting the whole society in on the thing to go against second pregnancies. social disapproval. So it's not a legal thing anymore, just legal, it's also social disapproval. They used that here with cigarette smoking. Big test, they started to indoctrinate children at school so that if you blew smoke 20 feet away, they go into a coughing fit, a paroxysm of coughing, and point at you like, oh, like one of these creatures from a horror movie. A Pavlovian response. And that's what they've decided to do in society, is just use the same psychological techniques of repetition until we all have these various types of Pavlovian responses. And when I said to this woman, but what gives you the right to decide who live and die? And she said to me, because then she suddenly remembered who she was talking to. I wasn't one of her cohorts. And she said, well, somebody has to do it. That was the simple response. Now, I've heard that same response on similar topics from other people who are in the working army, the Earth Army, as they sometimes call it, at the UN. That's their answer. Somebody has to do it. It all makes perfect sense to them. This is similar to a guy I bumped into in my travels who was a big arms dealer. Very pleasant man. Very pleasant. And you'll find that with most of them. They seem gracious, in fact, in company. Concerned about, do you have enough coffee, like something to drink, yada yada yada. They'll pull out the chairs for the ladies to sit on, and very courteous. And they will have genuine cares and concerns about people or their own families and so on. But one night I was sitting chatting, and I said, you know, all of these things you're making, these armaments and all the bullets and so on, are going to end up killing people. They might even be used back in Canadians one day. And he said to me, he says, I don't care. He said, I sell to whoever needs them. He said, whoever wants them. I just want to be rich. And he said it not in a facetious way. He was being very honest about it. I could tell by the way he said it. We have these odd people who are able to profit from wars, rationalize it quite easily to themselves, even though it sounds absurd to people like me, and they have no problem, even there's no stammering, there's no hesitancy in their answers. They're telling you generally how they feel. And you find it's incomprehensible how a person can care so much about family, other friends, and so on, but have that kind of attitude towards what he's chosen to do. These people really do exist. And this is a telling period for humanity, because there's a separation taking place. The separation has been talked about in previous ages, as it's called, where society gets to such a stage of corruption from the top to the bottom that something happens, either man-made or whatever, and most folk are wiped out. Others have taken some sort of moral stance concerning this story. That there's a change in certain humans themselves. There are certain humans alive who are different from the rest. And these ones come through. Whereas those who are still base do not. Now the elite believe that they are the superior ones and that they will come through. And yet they are the most evil creatures on the planet. People worship very old noble families who got their wealth and their power by slaughtering everyone else around them generally because they had a big family, going on from there, getting in cahoots with bankers who always go together with these people for armaments and so on, and going off and slaughtering other peoples and dominating them. And today we accept that they're descendants simply because it's tradition. If it's true that society likes a winner and loves a winner, then society is doomed if that's the kind of winner they truly like. Anyone who wins by any means possible. We're witnessing the end of humanity as we know it. Now, all the old holy books in other countries have this fable story in it, whatever it is. Even Judaism has it in it, that we go through these cycles, Talmudic Judaism, and that we reach a point of total debasement, and then catastrophe comes and people are wiped away. And I have to admit, I've seen the good and the bad in my life in extremes. I've seen the many in between, but I certainly have seen the extremes. But yet today, there are very few people who truly care what's going on. And don't be misled by groups and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, who are authorized by the big boys, who are always spouting for more things for the workers or for this or that or the other. This is all part of the agenda. I'm talking about people who really care, not because they're paid to, and because they say all the right things and have an ulterior agenda. But today, we're seeing the dividing line of those who care and the majority who do not. That point is past, in fact. It's already decided. And most do not care. By caring, I don't mean that you hear about something and it's maybe on your mind that night, then it's gone the next day. A caring is something that stays with you. A caring is something that once you realize what's happening somewhere to someone else, you can't just let it go. Regardless of the company you're in or the situation that happens, or you go to a party and everybody's laughing, it still stays with you. Those few people are very rare. They're rare people. And yet those are the ones who are bringing survival instincts into the next stage. The rest of them are gone, because if you don't care about others, you are allowing humanity to be extinguished. Part of survival mechanisms is based, even in the smallest tribe or the largest tribe, is based on caring for others. When you don't have it, you're doomed, because anything can and will be done to you. Growing up in Britain, during a time of mass upheaval, when the deindustrialization after World War II was continuing right down through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and all we had on television at news time was decrees by ministries of this and ministries of that from the government, pushing all of these decrees and all the bad news of layoffs and plant closures, and the reasons were never given. And it wasn't until the European Union, the big secret unification, was over and done with, and declassified their documents, they admitted they'd agreed in 1945 to deindustrialize Britain. Like old Rockefeller said, well, you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. So all those generations who grew up in misery and uncertainty in the era when Margaret Thatcher came on television and said, there's a generation growing up now who will never see work in their lifetime. Get used to it. That was all part of it. That was the omelette, you see. That was the eggs getting broken. Yeah. Just unfortunate, but it has to be because that's the plan, you see. And generations are included in the plan. And generations of misery and no hope and no future. That's the reality of those who rule and run and guide this world. These are the same people who make sure that the funding for research into science goes into specific areas which they will control for leading to total control of the individual. That's the sad truth of this world in which we live. But because we use this money, then we are paid and we will work for them and we build these big, big projects. We build the war machines. We pay universities to put up subsidies to match the subsidies from the foundations to research into specific areas, which will end up giving us more manacles to wear. We build our own chains. We always build our own chains in this system. Then we wonder, my goodness, how did that happen? How did that happen? Well, who do you think paid for all these monitors they're putting up? They put up all over Britain, for instance, and all over Europe, and they're putting up all over here. The taxpayers paid for them. The arms of government wanted them, but the taxpayers paid for them. They have microphones in many of them, boom microphones, which can pick up conversations 200 yards away in a shop doorway. And once again, the public are told, this is normal now, you're being watched. You have special people watching you. They won't rat and blackmail you or whatever. No, they're special people. They come out of different wombs than you and I, just like police and military people and politicians. And yet we live in the most corrupt age ever. So the ones at the top are more corrupt than anyone else. And you want to trust that. Well, good luck to you. When social Darwinism began to be taught, which really was just survival of the fittest, the elite were so happy to hear it voiced for the first time, something which they'd always believed in anyway, in their own inner religion. And this is something which they had to teach the people to believe in, because once you accept that life is just blobs of protoplasm with sparking synapses and electrochemical impulses racing through nervous systems, then you dehumanize, you take away any sacredness within life itself. And they have been at that so steadily for such a long time now, they've convinced most of the population that that is so. And when you convince the population that, well, life is just an accident, almost, but there's nothing great or mysterious about it, see, the scientists can dissect it and explain it all to you, and there's so much of it around anyway, it's not as if it's in scarce supply, therefore why bother grieving over those who are dying or sick or going to be killed in this war or the next war, or the many wars to come, the ongoing world war, which is on now, which is the war on terror. At one time, people fought to preserve the sacredness within humanity. They fought for that right. Today, it's out the window. It's in the trash bin. Most people don't care for anything outside of themselves. They're walking or racing composites, dashing to and fro to buy the next reward to please themselves at the end of the month. Anything they do for others is done for a reward. Nothing is given without expecting a reward. And it's a sad, sad comment that we've been reduced to this, but it was written about that this would happen. They did have to bring us to this point so they could get the next step, the next stage underway. And of course, they've been teaching this stuff in school so long now that generations have grown up thinking, well, that's it, it's Darwinian socialism, it makes perfect sense to me, it's survival of the fittest, the most aggressive intelligent have the right to dominate the rest and do as they will with the peasantry. And that's what we're watching. We acquiesce by our silence to their outlandish dictates. And their own historians can then go ahead and write, well, society went through this phase, there was no objection from the public. And that's how things are written. The public feel that they're powerless unless they belong to a non-governmental organization. But that's not true. The amount of people an individual can influence in their lives can be astonishing. And even if you influence 5 people in your lifetime, like the ancient Greek philosophers said, you'd accomplished wonders. I mean, to influence, to change something which made such an impact, to change people for the better without robbing them of their self. You'll find out there in the chaos that's been created and well funded into existence to trap those who are looking for truth. The minefield, as I call it, you get out the tunnel, you see the field, the forest is on the other side of the field, you want to run towards it, but then you find out there's mines buried everywhere across that field. The field is so enticing, because in that field you'll hear and see things you've never seen before, you get information you've never heard before, but it's always spun off in a direction to disable you from becoming much more than you already are, to bring you back into the loop. Before the elite make a single move in any direction, they plan all possible repercussions, like a chess game. And they set up and train people to become the leaders of groups that will arise to combat, or what seems to combat, the initial stimuli. Before anything is done, before the first move is made, they go over this meticulously. But what they cannot count on is the occasional individual here or there who doesn't fall into a category. Those who are unpredictable. When we forget the sacredness within humanity, you've just given away the only thing that could stop them from touching you. And have convinced whole populations that we're just walking little, as I said before, pieces of protoplasm who can be dissected, who can be harvested. Harvested before you even are clinically dead. And they're pushing further all the time because the fresh organs straight out the body are the best, to say. And the ghouls go to work. And we accept it because it's for a good cause. They call charity work. Same thing, same old Masonic thing down through the ages. It's for a good cause. But we look at the horror that's caused in this good cause and where it's going. And people should really ponder deeply and carefully. Next week, I'll go into other topics, of course, with maybe some good news here and there, hopefully. And if I wanted, I could target the big audiences by telling them nice things, which make them go to bed feeling fuzzy and warm and happy. But I've never ever pretended that was here to grab the bulk of the populace. I've always looked for the uncommon man or woman, because those are the only ones that truly count. The rest are composites of their conditioning, of their training. And yes, and somewhere in deep within them, there's also the fact that they prefer to make certain choices. So forgive this talk tonight. It's a bit slow. I'm tired tonight. Ponder these things carefully, and may your God go with you. All the best. Good night.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark.
Hello, this is Alan Watt. And today, it is the 12th of January, 2007. It's very interesting to realize that even in theosophy, when the 1800s was a tremendous time of turmoil and pushing for this new age to begin as the new Aquarius was coming up. And they dreamed up theosophy to bring in other groups, especially the women, who'd up until that time been pretty well excluded from any type of Freemasonry. The Grand Lodge of France did bring some in. So they came up with Theosophy and the front woman, the actress Blavatsky, to push Theosophy, where they said the old Aryan stuff or histories of the fifth Aryan race it's a Hindu philosophy to do with the end of time. Each time is a part of an age, a period, where only the fittest, those worthy, as they say, survive, are allowed to come through, and by no means must the inferior types, the old man and woman, be allowed through. They haven't evolved enough, and because the whole thing does go around evolution. Even the Aryan is derived from Hurrian. It's a pronunciation difference, that's all. So here we are, the collateral and the backing for wars, which we are simply put on the books to be part of. And we know that too. We understand that part of it. We accept it, at least. And most people are able to suppress or even deny their complicity in what's happening in the world. And yet, part of their paycheck is taken to go to many things which they might not personally agree with. If they were to sit and dwell upon them at all. But in the mass man of today, they find it difficult to look at themselves honestly, very, almost impossibly so. Unless you understand yourself, the conscious and the unconscious part, the raging sea of unconsciousness, you won't understand your own part in this, and you'll deny it to the end. That's why old Christianity gave you a devil. It was such a burden to bear, the understanding of guilt and complicity in evil. It was easier to throw this on top of some other deity and let them take responsibility. Or in the old Judaic scapegoat, where they'd set it off into the desert to carry the sins of the people. If only it were that easy. I remember an old Star Trek episode, one of the first ones, the first series, where on board the ship comes a man who, he was using sort of stage makeup, half his face was white, the other half was black, and he's trying to get them all to go to get ready to fight this enemy that was coming. Well, his enemy was an exact duplicate of himself, exact, only The other part of the face was white, another part was black. The dualism, the yin and yang in humankind, the unconscious will always project its problems onto an enemy. Any enemy will do. And unfortunately, the longer the enemy appears to exist, the more fixed and embedded that becomes. This is understood with those who run the world. And that's why they'll like to have ongoing wars and clashes and intergenerational wars as they guide the whole process into a predetermined conclusion, with always an unexpected answer to it all. And yet those at the end are so exhausted they're willing to take anything, and that's generally what they get. The complexity of the human mind is sometimes overblown, for everyone has projected their own problems, their own faults, frailties onto other people at some time. The allegories of Adam and Eve, although there's many levels of that, not the esoteric stuff that's taught in the churches, but even a lower level, when Eve was tempted and then questioned later on as to why she broke the law, she immediately said, well, in essence, well, the devil tempted her, the devil made her do it. And because of Adam's own personal needs in that woman, when he was questioned, he blamed Eve for bringing it to him. The honest answer was, because I wanted what was promised. That would have been Eve's honest answer. It's easy to project that something else made you do it. We're complicit in everything that these boring people at the top with their boring speeches puts us into, and yet we don't participate openly in any of the decision making. It's done on the subconscious and the unconscious level. If I'm okay, and me and mine are fine, and people are keeping off my back as much as possible, then I don't really care what's happening anywhere else. That's a short-sighted attitude, because eventually when the dominoes fall, it comes round to you, and there's no one there to keep you propped up. This is not any kind of democracy at all. When I was young, really small, I used to listen to all the chatter that happened in the world I was living in, and my daily routines, and realized that most of the chatter even then was simply the reiteration of magazines or TV or radio news. And yet it was done with such exuberance, with little groups, chatter, 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 gossip. And I pictured all the words that's ever been spoken on the planet going off into space, all joined together, and wondering how far on the galaxy it would loop to come back and mean absolutely nothing. And then I pictured generations of people who'd lived and died, all the graveyards on the planet where people had done all the right things as they were supposed to do according to tradition of the time, and never knew what was going on. Generations and generations have had the right to consciousness stolen, robbed, living and dying and never knowing, never knowing. Just the external stuff that's fed to them by later historians, the whitewashed, sifted flower that comes out of history. I mentioned before that some people in the past and present, and it's something that certain individuals will come to in every generation, when they do understand this topic I'm on today, they come to the conclusion that perhaps it's not all good people who are up against a minority of bad people. Perhaps there's only a minority of good people. And that rankles us because we always think of ourselves as being good. We follow the rules of the system we live in. We do these socially acceptable things according to the laws and rules and traditions that have been drawn up for us. And sure enough, you can be in trouble and people come to your aid. Hopefully. Hopefully that still works today if you're allowed to without FEMA intervention. We can help each other and we'll see we are good people. And on that basis we are. But how easily we can stop ourselves from being good to others, people we don't know, people we see on the one-eyed monster of TV, locked in a death struggle with others, in either a traditional war or a recent conflict, and it doesn't affect us. Why can we switch on and switch off? The reason being that we help others around us, close to us, maybe one day they'll help us if need be. We can't imagine those over yonder helping us. You see, so we're selfish in a sense. When you give, you do it because you want to give, not because you expect something in return. Every motive has to be questioned on a personal level. Recently someone sent me one of the many DVDs that are out there on some of the history of Freemasonry, done by that select group of the usual people who lead this. And I have to tell those who live on this kind of stuff, it's almost like a hobby. They feed on it. They like to be astounded through this amazing secretive organization and learn little things and quips about them. In reality, there's nothing out there that they haven't allowed you to know. And to hear people who are supposedly learned talk about the exoteric over and over, to me personally, becomes boring. They make it sound almost exciting the way that they question Freemasonry and try to expose it. It's the best recruitment technique there is, actually, because the young always go towards the forbidden fruit. It's nature. In fact, I think Pike and Mackay also said that was the best recruitment drive ever was, is when the government of the US for a very short period pretended to clamp down on Freemasonry. It made it an exciting thing for the youth to want to grow up, to become, to get into. That's standard, that's what happens. If you tell me don't take drugs, don't smoke, it makes it more appealing. That's what happens. But people who seem to be educated will still have their biases. And many of these videos are put out there by exoteric Christianity. Those who understand on an intellectual level the concepts of Christianity, but they miss the esoteric, because the numinous experience isn't there with it. The idealistic experience that's supposed to be a transcendent experience, which isn't a sudden, limited, short-lasting thing. It's a life-altering thing. It's an understanding which comes supposedly with it. They miss that because they're formalized Christians. Formalized Christians are traditional Christians, cultural Christians. The whole idea of a transcendent figure to follow was meant to be an example for those to come. idealistically. When you're caught up in tradition, you lose the meaning of anything, any truth. This happens over and over in every people, culture, and religion. You end up joining a club, a social club, or a tribal club, doesn't matter. And tribal clubs tend to club each other to death eventually if they have a slight difference of opinion or belief. They used to say that the road to heaven was narrow. That's a clue. It was never meant for the mass of humanity. For even in ancient times, they understood the masses, those who stay within the mass. And you can tell them by their topics of conversation. They would always take the broad way, Broadway. Even the names are written down in streets to give you clues. The material world is what it meant. Something that is tangible, the material world. Most people will always rush towards that which they can easily understand and hope to conquer or grab a piece of. To come to any understanding in this world takes a lot of work. And the breaking into consciousness on an individual level can be a hard task for many people, too hard for most people. You, like a staging rocket, must leave many parts of yourself behind, the old you in different phases, as you ascend. And because you're doing it yourself, you simply cannot pass on the experiences to other people who want formula and ritual. That is what religion is for. It's for the mass. That's why you go to the mass. It's for the masses. Something simple to understand on a certain level through ritual and formality and repetition. It's all done for you. There's no real participation except to follow the rituals themselves, which you need not even understand on a deep level. The traditional levels are generally good enough for most people. We can't possibly stop immediately the evil in this world, especially when it's been here since at least the beginning of money, and the potential had to exist prior to that. For the evil that's wrought in the world could be wrought by any one of us under different circumstances. How can you keep yourself in check if you don't know yourself? You leave that to the formalized rules of culture and law, which is the big deterrent. But how many people really check themselves? We'll all say we're good people. But what is good? Who defines the good? If good is not doing harm to others, then we're all pretty bad. Since we allow ourselves to be taxed, and that money to be used by organizations and departments which employ educable people who will work consistently creating weapons of mass destruction and projected onto their enemies for doing the same thing. Are we really that good when we allow it to happen? When even a formal complaint to a government saying, look, I object to this, this is not a human thing to do, or a humane thing to do, according to our conscience. Not by our religious conscience or traditional conscience or whatever cultural conscience we've been given, but your personal conscience. And you could always add, I know I can't do anything else except complain to you, but at least you've stated your position. It's better than nothing. Nothing is always easier, certainly. And being the cowards most people are, they don't realize the more they retreat into cowardice, the more their bill is going to be at the end. Because what goes around comes around, and they'd wish they'd had the time to do all the complaining when there is no time to do it and no one to complain to. There are many things which you can only teach to a few, and even then you have to be discerning. Most people want to see what will profit them, and I don't teach people to go out and profit in the usual sense. Good night for me, from Hamish Madog as well, and may your God go with you.
Special way we all get there anyway. speak, but all the words were dead. Talked all night and left it all unsaid. So we agreed to disagree. At least we got our man.